Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, two big announcements this past week. We're going to address both of them. One is the release of the preliminary GDP, gross domestic product numbers for the U.S. economy for last year and the fourth quarter. We'll unpack that and see what that really means. And also, the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell's announcement publicly here this past week, in which he indicated interest rates are going to rise starting in March. And the debate is how much of a rate and how fast will they come? Pundits are saying, oh, we're going to see 5 rate increases this year. Well, what is the impact on the real economy, particularly, you know, this argument that, oh, the Fed is raising rates to stop inflation, slow down inflation. How accurate is that? Can it really have an effect on inflation by dampening demand when the problem with inflation now is the supply side and price gouging by monopolistic corporations? Can Fed raising rates really address supply side issues or price gouging issues? What is the administration doing about the price gouging other than saying, oh, they're going to do something in the future to increase competition? Okay, so those are the two topics that we're going to jump into here, talking about GDP. Once again, we've been talking about it from time to time, but we've got the numbers preliminary here. And then we'll talk about how the Fed rate hikes coming play into this. Okay, let's start with the number one question, and that is, the Biden administration is hyping the fact that GDP increase for 2021, which was 5.7% GDP growth, you know, the fastest growth in 38 years. Oh, sounds good, doesn't it? 38 years. Well, you know, what does it really mean, 38 years? Well, it sounds pretty good. 5.7% sounds pretty good. Well, is it really pretty good? Let's look at it. You know, the truth is always in the details. Well, you know, 38 years record growth, it sounds good. But yet, poll after poll, you know, we hear of average consumers, households saying, oh, wow, this economy just isn't benefiting me. I'm not too happy about what's going on. In other words, a lot of angst out there in the real world about the economy. Well, who's right? You know, is it 38 years record growth, or is it, I don't feel so good about all this? You know, we're going in the wrong direction. Who's right? Is it, you know, are the consumers right? You know, are the politicians right? A big gap between the two messages going on there. Well, let's look at that. Okay, first of all, 5.7% GDP is really on an annual basis, right? The U.S. likes to report its quarterly growth in GDP annualized. In other words, you take a quarter, right, of GDP, and you multiply it roughly by 4, make some seasonal adjustments in addition, and that gives you the annual rate. Unlike in Europe, where they report quarter to quarter, which is really the best indicator, you're not taking a quarter and then multiplying it by 4. Okay, so we have 5.7% for last year. And in the fourth quarter, we have even a higher, 6.9%, I think. Well, you know, the recent quarter will show you what the real trends are and where that's GDP is going in 2022. Well, let's look at the fourth quarter. GDP, you know, is the total goods and services made and sold in a given year or in a given quarter. That's how they estimate what's called nominal GDP before it's adjusted for the inflation rate. What they report when they say 5.7 is real GDP. In other words, adjusted for inflation. Now, if you underestimate inflation, you're going to overestimate real GDP. So the index that you use, the price index that you use to estimate inflation, is very important for that GDP number that they actually report. Now, you may think that, they're going to adjust it for the 7% inflation we had last year in the consumer price index. No, they don't use the consumer price index to adjust nominal GDP. They use another index called the GDP deflator index. Now, that index is far lower than GDP. So real GDP is much higher. If they use the CPI to adjust nominal GDP, you would get a real GDP much lower than 5.7%. Now, you and I, we buy things based upon CPI. So for us, the GDP is actually much lower than what they report based on the GDP deflator index. Well, why is the GDP deflator index so much lower? Well, there's a lot of changes in the way they estimate inflation in the GDP index, and it includes a lot of business goods that are sold that you and I, as consumers, CPI, don't buy, right? And, when you throw more things into the pot, you lower the average, especially if the things are less than 7%, right? Business goods sold to businesses and so forth. Okay, so here's an example of why the GDP deflator price index is so much lower. Just one example, right? Let's take rents. Okay, there's 50 million, roughly 50 million rental units in the United States, right? People who are renting. And we know those rents are going up very fast. Those rents are double-digit increases, especially now that you got these big financial asset companies, BlackRock and others, who are buying up all these apartments and business rental units everywhere. We know that's double-digit. But the GDP deflator, right, also takes 50 million homeowners and assumes homeowners pay themselves for rent. Well, that's pretty oxymoron, isn't it? Yeah, but that's what they do. And it assumes that rent they pay themselves is only about 2% a year. So in a GDP deflator, you take the actual renter increase for renters, and you add the 2% increase in what homeowners pay themselves in rent, and you lower the rent number, the rent price increase number, significantly as a result. That's one of the reasons, many reasons, why the GDP deflator is much less than the CPI, Consumer Price Index. And then there's less of these examples that go on. But the thing is, you get a GDP deflator number. I haven't seen that, but it's always about a third less than the CPI number, the 7%. And if your inflation adjustment is GDP deflator and much less, your real output, real GDP number, is going to be higher. So you got to reduce that 5.7%. Now, there's another problem with GDP, and that is almost a decade ago, I think it was 2013, they changed the definition of what's included in GDP. Before that, things called intellectual property and things like company logos, right, and publications and so forth, and research and development, which wasn't included, those things they threw into GDP and say, oh, that's really investment. And you get such nonsense like, well, what's the value of Nike's logo? And the government says, well, how much is the value of your logo increased the past year? And Nike says, oh, 10% or whatever, right? Well, how the hell do you figure out the value of a logo particularly if you just ask the company what the value is. And a company likes to increase the valuation of such amorphous intellectual property because it makes their balance sheet look better, right? So they report, oh, you know, it's up 10% or whatever, and the government says, okay, well, who are we to challenge what you think the value of your logo is? Because the logo is not sold anywhere in the market to determine the value of the logo. And the same thing with R&D, you know, research and development. That used to be a cost for businesses. Oh, and now they're saying, no, R&D is really an investment. Okay. So we're going to add that to GDP as well. So what you got is, back 10 years ago almost, is $500 billion extra added to the GDP totals. Now, it's probably higher, you know, 8-9 years later, in terms of that questionable redefinition of GDP to add to boost the value of GDP by boosting the value of investment. Now, GDP is made up of four categories, really. It's consumer spending, final goods, consumer spending. It's business investment, and business investment is made up of equipment investment, of structures, in other words, commercial property, office buildings and hotels and casinos and malls and factories and so forth, right? That's what they call structures. And there's residential structures, which is housing and apartments and so forth. Equipment, structures, IP, this amorphous category, and inventories. Now, if you look at inventories this past year, they fell for the first 9 months. And then they boomed in the fourth quarter. And that big boom in inventory accumulation by businesses was by far the major contributor to fourth quarter GDP. Now, why did it boom in the fourth quarter? Oh, because the economy began to reopen last summer, and businesses started piling on inventory in the expectations that consumers around the fourth quarter business Christmas holiday would spend like hell. Well, they didn't spend like hell. Another reason why businesses boosted inventories is because of the supply chain problems that began to appear in September and October. So they quickly tried to accumulate as much as they could in expectation of supply chain problems. Well, those two factors, reopening economy, supply chain problems, expectation of consumer sales, really was responsible for inventory, historic inventory accumulation after 9 months of decline. Well, consumer spending did not really appear as aggressively in the fourth quarter as they thought. And business is now sitting on massive inventories. Guess what they're going to do here in 2022? They're not going to continue building up those inventories. They're going to let them run off. As they don't build up, that's not going to add to GDP. In fact, if they let it run off, that will subtract from GDP in 2022. So you got to look at these details, see? Well, what about equipment spending? Pretty much flat. Business spending on equipment is pretty much flat. What about spending on commercial property, real estate, you know, office buildings and so forth? Nada. Negative. That's not forthcoming. Oh, what about spending on residential housing? Big supply problems. Not going to build a lot of new houses. You know, probably won't sell as many of them because they're so damn expensive now. I'm not talking about houses that already exist and are resold. That doesn't occur in GDP at all. That's a used good, which they don't account in GDP. Any kind of used goods aren't accounted. You sell your used car, that does not contribute to GDP at all, only the production of new cars. And we know new cars are not being produced, just like new houses, at the rate that they used to be before COVID. Well, that results in auto companies raising their prices because of the supply problem. That results in home builders raising their prices because of the supply problem. Supply is driving inflation. Oh, but more than supply is driving inflation, as I've said before on this show. What we got is inflation due to just pure price gouging by monopolistic corporations that can. It's price gouging, using the reopening of the economy, using the excuse of supply chain problems to raise prices exorbitantly. Well, a good example are the oil companies. They've raised prices here 50%. We got oil prices now, crude oil prices, around $90 a barrel. That's, you know, over 50% increase in crude. At the pump, it's 50% increase, consumer price index. Yeah. Well, you know, do the oil companies have a shortage? No, there's a glut of oil. And the U.S. government's throwing more oil onto the market as well. So there's no shortage of oil to justify it. Is there an excess demand for oil? No. Demand does, you know, we've had some reopening and some demand for, transport oil, but not that much. Demand does not change that dramatically. And there is no supply gut. So why the hell are the oil companies raising their prices? Because they can. Because they're monopolies. And they're gouging the hell out of us once again. When was the last time they gouged us in terms of oil prices here? Well, the spring of 2008. And they ran that price of crude oil almost up to $150 a barrel. Well, you know, it was down to 38, 35 during COVID. Now it's up to 90. And it's on its way to over $100 a barrel again. You know, economists have not accurately assessed the role of that kind of a rapid price increase in crude oil in the spring of 2008 and its contribution to the crash in the second half of 2008 in the economy. They've ignored it. Whenever we've had such a run-up, severe run-up of inflation, which, as I've said, is CPI, now over 10%, not 7%, whenever we've had such a run-up of inflation, particularly oil inflation, always been followed by a recession. Will that prove the case? Well, we will see. You know, we had a big run-up in inflation. Let's look at this historically. Back in 80, 81, right? Big recession, 81, 82. We had a run-up in 89, 90, recession 91. We had a big run-up with the tech boom in the late 1990s. Recession 2001. And, of course, the inflation run-up, an oil price run-up in 2008, the crash of 2009-10. Well, we got this big inflation running up, driven largely by oil, and on top of that, some legitimate supply chain, global supply chain problems, and domestic supply chain problems. We got this going on again. Will history not repeat? Will we end up, you know, without a recession? I don't think so. I think we got one coming here. If not late 2022, 2023, right? We will have a recession simply because of the price increase, and you cannot get a soft landing here when you have that kind of inflation. Okay, so back to GDP. You know, let's go back to GDP. As I've said, to recap, GDP is over this 5.7% last year, which, by the way, is a preliminary number. We got a final number, an intermediate and final number coming next month and a month thereafter. And it's the second estimate that tends to be more accurate. The first estimate that we just got here this week, it tends to be changed, but we'll see what that is. So we're talking about the preliminary, right? 5.7%. Right. And to recap, you know, what I'm saying is that it's overestimated because they use the GDP deflator, certainly overestimated for median families whose inflation is really based on CPI. CPI itself is underestimated, I believe, for reasons I've talked about on the show before. So, you know, we've got an overestimated because of the inflation adjustment on GDP here. And we've got an overestimation because of the structural definition of GDP that was put into effect in 2013. Also consider the fact that the 5.7 comes off of a deep contraction in 2020 of GDP. The economy contracted. So a 5.7%, you know, on a contracted GDP, you're going to have an excess recovery when you come off of a deep contraction like we had in 2020. You got to keep that in mind. So how much of GDP is really growth or just recovering, reopening the economy and recovering for what was lost? You know, the economy contracted by over 10% in the first half of 2020, recovered about two-thirds of that in the second half, and then sort of closed down again last winter, 2021, and now reopened over the summer a second time, right? You know, it's in some categories, some areas of the economy, we're back to where we were in 2019. In other areas of the economy, we're still below 2019 in a number of ways. You know, if you contract, if you start in 2020 with a 20 trillion GDP, roughly, you know, and then you contract 10%, well, you lose 10% of 20 trillion, $2 trillion, you're down to 18 trillion, right? This is just by way of an example. These aren't exact numbers. Okay, so if you grow 5.7% on that lower 18 trillion, well, then you add a little over 1 trillion back. Well, you haven't added all of it back, have you? Right? You're not really, 5.7 doesn't bring you totally back. Well, they argue in certain categories, sectors of the economy, we've totally recovered, right? A good example of that is jobs. You know, this is the other bragging point of the Biden administration. They say, we created 6 million jobs. They didn't create 6 million jobs. 6 million people went back to work to the jobs they had. That's not creating jobs. That's just restoring jobs. It's an important distinction, I think. All right. Well, how many people did not come back? Millions yet. We haven't fully recovered in the labor market. Yet they say, oh, the labor market is so strong. That's a way of saying, oh, it's wage inflation that's going to drive inflation. Okay, but is it so strong? No, look, we got 4.5 million people who dropped out of the labor force. They're unemployed, but they're not calculated in that 3.9% unemployment rate. Neither are the tens of millions of people who are still working part-time, voluntary, right? Part-time, temps, gigs. Yeah? They're not included in that 3.9%. That's only full-time employed unemployed. And then, of course, you know, we've got at least a couple million females, moms, who, because of the mess in the schools and COVID and so forth, have not been able to return to work. You know, I think a lot of it also is they just can't find childcare anymore, or it's too damn expensive. How the hell do they go back to work when they'd be working for nothing, right? Or they can't even find child. Childcare is a big problem. Much bigger than they're admitting here. If you look at the problem with the labor force participation, it's mostly women who haven't come back. And that's because of this childcare problem and the cost of childcare, which, of course, they subsidized a little bit last year for 6 months. By moving forward, the childcare credit you would have gotten here in April 2022, they just moved it forward into last year and gave you on a monthly amortized basis what you would have got here a year later. But they cut that out now. They cut that out. Well, that's a major area of why people are so discontent. The childcare situation and the cost of childcare. And, of course, the inflation, which is whacking everybody's real wages. You know, if inflation goes up, even if you get a 4% increase in wages, you know, the cost of living, CPI, is 7%, you're still going backwards. You know, even those workers, you know, in John Deere and other places, union places, where they went on strike and they thought they got big increases, 5%, you know. Wow. Well, it's not really 5%, you know. In real terms, it's less than what they had. So, you know, that's another area of why people feel discontented. It's the inflation. It's the child care, right? It's the realization that they were treated like crap by their employers, particularly some of these service companies, you know, and they're saying, hell with this. I'm not coming back to this. You know, all these reasons are why people feel all this angst and discontent, even though, well, we got 5.7%. GDP growth, whoa, you know, record, 38-year record. Well, it doesn't really resonate as that great a deal for most households, most working class, even middle class households. We still have over 12 million people jobless when you really count all the dropouts and all these other factors that I talked about. Again, what you hear, the jobless rate is a what's called the government's U-3 unemployment rate, which is just full-time workers. You know, no part-time, no people left the labor force. All these other problems are excluded from that calculation. And then the CPI itself, as I said, is underestimated. Why? Because, you know, there's like 450 goods in the basket of CPI, and they're given certain weights. In other words, not everything is calculated that's evenly contributing to CPI inflation. Obviously, you know, food is going to have a larger weight in the calculation of the 7%, and so is lodging, you know, your rents, your mortgages, and so forth. That's going to have a greater weight. Transportation, gas, and so forth, that's going to have a greater weight than, say, you know, buying shoes, right? Or going to a restaurant. Well, I don't know. Restaurants, you know, pretty damn expensive, aren't they? Yeah, all the prices have gone up at least 20-25%. People just aren't going to restaurants, I think, because the prices are so high. Okay, so, you know, the weights issue. CPI inflation, in other words, for your median income wage family, working class family, is in effect much larger than the 7%. All other things equal, not even calculating other problems with the CPI, right? Well, they say the Republicans and the media says, oh, it's because we gave people too much money, right? The American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion, was too much, right? And it's demand. People are spending all this money, right? They have all this savings that they accumulated from all the government handouts, and now they're spending it, and that's driving prices up. It's demand, therefore we got to get rid of these programs. That's Republican mantra, and the Democrats have bought into that a lot. Demand side, you know, they reopened the economy, and oh, they gave so much money to people in the spring here in March with the rescue plan. Well, you know, there's probably some demand involved in reopening the economy in the third quarter of this year. You know, it's like $5 trillion, maybe a couple trillion of which was not being spent before. You know, well, how much did the American Rescue Plan add to that? All they say is $1.9 trillion, right? Oh, that's over 5 years or 10 years, right? Actually, the amount of spending that was estimated for the first year was $800 billion. That's all. And, of course, in one quarter, you're going to get maybe $200 billion of that. So, you know, compare the impact on demand of a couple trillion dollars new spending because of just the reopening of the economy. Compare that to $200 billion additional from the American Rescue Plan. Well, obviously, it's to be opening the economy. To what extent demand is contributing to inflation? It's not the American Rescue Plan, which, by the way, you know, was cut significantly here in terms of unemployment and rent assistance and child care at the end of last year. So it's not that at all. The American Rescue Plan contributed nil, virtually nil, to demand side, which is very minimal impact on inflation. to what extent you have demand-side impact is because you opened the economy. Look at the CPI. As of last spring, it was still only 1.6% annual rate. The CPI began to surge in August and September. Yeah, well, that's about when we got the supply problems, wasn't it? Reopening the economy, oh, they couldn't get the supply. And at the same time, you know, your big corporations say, hey, you know, we're going to recoup some of our profit loss in 2020 by raising prices, especially the oil companies, right? And rental companies raising their rents now. And food companies, meat packers. I mean, the demand for meat did not increase or because of supply problems or demand problems here in the second half of last year. No, we got four big meat packers who are gouging everybody, raising prices. And, you know, the Biden administration kind of acknowledged that. They came out last year and they said, oh, we're going to increase competition in some of these industries. Well, you increase competition, you increase supply. Increase supply, prices go down. That's the logical economic argument. The problem is, it's just talk. How the hell do you increase competition in meatpacking? Well, you got to start other meatpacking companies. How long does it take to create a new meatpacking company? And who's going to jump in and do that? It's what economists call barriers to entry. It's hard to simply increase competition and therefore supply in these monopolistic industries. It's all talk. You know, it's all happy talk. You know, increasing competition, bullshit. That's not going to lower prices. No way. It's just a, you know, politician's excuse not to go after the price gougers, you know, not to go after the big meatpacking companies and chicken companies and so forth that are really gouging the hell out of prices, or the cereal companies, you know, creating bread prices and cereal prices and so forth, right? Or the other areas of increase going on, paper companies and so forth, you know, driving up the price. To some extent, there's a supply problem with some of them. They can't get lumber, right? But there's no supply problem, producing beef or pork, right? They're just raising their prices 20% because they can. And the administration says, oh, we're going to increase competition. You know, that's bullshit. You know, that's not true. That's a cover. That's the way to put a spin on a message to the public that we're doing something about it. They really want to do something about it. Well, they would slap some price controls on these companies, right? And the same with the oil companies. As I said, raising their prices 50%, right, at the pump. Right? In California, where I am, you know what it costs for a gallon of gas? $5.50 for a gallon of gas in the Bay Area. Yeah. How many people can commute 40, 50 miles every day back and forth, right, paying $5.50 a gallon? Well, a lot of those people say, hey, you know, I got that problem. I got the problem of child care. Shit, I'm not going back to work. You know, can you blame them? Why should they work for nothing? Okay, so, you know, we have a problem, inflation. We have a weights issue problem. It's not demand very much. It's supply chain, global supply chain problems, no doubt, right? No doubt. And as China has economic production issues over there in its economy, well, then you're going to have continued supply chain problems, right? But the supply chain problems are domestic as well. It's not just getting foreign goods into our ports on the West Coast. It's how do you get those goods to the warehouses inland and from the warehouses inland to the company warehouses and from there to the stores? Well, you got to have truck drivers. Well, there's not enough truck drivers. Why? Well, because real wages for truck drivers has dropped a third in the last decade. So why the hell should anyone go into driving a truck? Same thing if you're an independent 18-wheeler, right? A contractor. Independent contractor trying to pick stuff up at the port and take it, right? You know, if the gas is $5 a gallon and you got to sit in line for hours with your engine idling, you know, just to pick up a container, well, you're going to start losing money pretty damn quick. and then you're just not going to go to the port. Well, that's going on too, you see. So there's supply problems in the economy as well as global shipping that are driving up the prices. And because prices are going up for legitimate supply reasons, you got the price gouger saying, we're going to take advantage of this. We're going to hide behind the supply problem and raise our prices, even though we don't have a supply problem. So that's what's going on with inflation, which is much higher than reporting, and therefore GDP much lower than they're reporting. And it explains a lot of the angst of average households. You know, I saw a poll that's, you know, what are the major one? I think it's an NBC poll. What are the major concerns of economic concerns of households today? Number one, 85% inflation. Number one. And, you know, it's not going away. Even Fed Chairman Powell now is admitting that all these supply problems are chronic. Auto companies are saying, oh, you know, our chip problem is on, going to run into 2023. They don't care as long as they make more profits by raising their prices, even though it means they sell less. You see, there's three ways to make profits, fundamentally, right? You can reduce your costs, get rid of workers, you know, exchange them for artificial intelligence software-based decision-making, right? That's one way. The other way is to sell more stuff, right? Volume, revenue, volume, sales. And the other way is to raise your prices. Now, if you're monopolistic companies, like oil companies, it's easier to raise prices than it is to sell more. In fact, you know, with alternative energy, you may be selling less. Well, okay, maybe let's raise prices even more. So that's what's going on here. Price gouging, number one, cause of inflation, right? Number two, supply chains, both domestic and global, and only then demand, and demand mostly from reopening the economy, and not demand from that minuscule impact on the real economy from the American Rescue Plan, which is now being taken away. Oh, they're talking about now, infrastructure. You know, Biden's going to start running around the country hyping on infrastructure, you know, especially after this morning he goes, where was it, Pittsburgh, I think it was? I'm not sure. It's in Pennsylvania somewhere. And on his visit, the bridge collapses. Yeah, well, that's because, you know, for a decade or more, Republicans and Democrats have refused to spend on infrastructure. Why? You know, it's not as profitable as spending on defense goods, or not as profitable as spending on real estate, right? Or investing in financial assets, stocks and bonds and so forth. You know, that's much more profitable. So, let's not throw our government stimulus and spending in the direction of infrastructure. Well, you know, it's gotten so bad, they've had to do something about that. But the infrastructure spending isn't going to hit the economy and do much good until late this year at the earliest. These are big projects. You won't see a real effect on the economy until later this year. But that's the only story Biden's got, you know, hype infrastructure. You know, his other bills are dead on arrival. He can't get anything through thanks to the corporate interests within the Democratic Party with their shills, Manchin and Sinema. You know, they're blocking everything. So that's all he's got. And so he's going to go out and start hyping that. At the same time, you know, what we've got here is the Fed indicating this week that they're going to raise interest rates. So how does that play into all we've talked about, into GDP and into inflation? What's the effect of that? And why is the focus now totally on the Federal Reserve and monetary policy to try to do something about inflation and the economy? Well, you know, what Powell said here, I think it was on Wednesday, was that pretty much explicitly as you can without actually doing it, that interest rates are going to rise here starting in March, definitely. And all the discussion going on now in the media and the pundits is, well, how much will he raise it? How many raises will there be in 2022 and how high will they go? You got the pundits saying, oh, there's going to be 5 increases in Fed rates here. These are, you know, Treasury rates that set the benchmark for all the other interest rates of the economy. You know, you got the 10-year Treasury bond, and you got the 5-year Treasury notes, and 2-year and shorter Treasury bills. All those are Fed-driven rates that become benchmarks, you know, for mortgage rates, variable rates, the prime rate for business investment, and so forth, right? So the Fed sort of sets the pace on rates. And if the Fed starts raising its rates, then other bank rates will follow, according to theory, at least. Probably true. So, you know, the Fed's going to start raising rates. And the argument is, oh, it's got to raise rates in order to dampen inflation. In other words, the Fed is going to control inflation. No way, Jose. The Fed can't affect inflation unless it raises rates so high that it throws the economy into a recession. Only then will the Fed affect inflation by whacking demand. Yeah, the Fed has no influence over supply, which is the source of the problem, and certainly price gouging. The Fed can only affect inflation by crushing demand, and it's got to crush demand. In other words, it's got to raise rates so fast and so high that it throws those industries dependent upon interest rates for sales into chaos. What are those industries? Well, the housing industry. One, mortgage rates have a big effect on housing expansion, right? And therefore housing employment, construction. Autos, big effect on whether people buy a new car or not. Small businesses who borrow from banks. Big businesses don't borrow from banks, say, but the small businesses do. So if you raise interest rates, you know, for business loans, they're not going to take out the loan, and therefore you're going to have less business investment through small, medium businesses. Big businesses raise money not by borrowing from banks. They raise money by issuing corporate bonds, you see, and commercial paper and other securities. So, okay, so let's say the Fed raises rates, right? That will certainly dampen those three industries, right? It will have an impact on housing and construction. It will have an impact on autos. It will have an impact on small business investment. It may even, affect credit cards. The terms in credit cards will become more stringent. Okay. Is that going to even affect demand that much? Well, let's look at those industries. Right? How much do they contribute to GDP? How much of GDP is composed of housing construction, of auto sales, a small business investment? Less than 20%. So we're going to raise rates, right? That's going to try to dampen demand, therefore employment, and therefore consumption, wages and consumptions, right? In less than 20% of the economy, the real economy. Yeah. Now you're going to have another negative effect here already we're seeing by raising rates. And that is, it's going to precipitate a significant contraction in the stock market bubble. It's just looking for a way to contract, right? Raising rates will do that. Just the announcement that they are going to raise rates is causing all kind of havoc in stock markets, right? Already you see this big churn. You got days of big collapse, and then the buy the dip investors jump in because they think they got 6 more weeks before Fed does raise rates, and it comes back, and then it, you know, big contraction and so forth. This is a sign that the stock market is at its peak and is churning. And if they do actually raise the rates, you're going to see a significant reversal in the stock markets. And when that happens, people who purchase consumer goods based upon what's called the wealth effect, in other words, I feel wealthier because my stock prices are, investments are rising, I'm going to go buy a new car, right? Those folks, which is part of consumption, right? They're going to pull in their horns. They're not going to buy those cars or those yachts, you know, or those second homes or whatever. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, 10% of all the stock, or 89% of all the stock is owned by 10% of the population. And most of that's in the top 1%, you know. So most of the economy, 90% of all households, don't have much stock investments, maybe a little in 401k plans that they don't touch, right? So they don't really consume things based upon the stock market movement. They will consume things based upon their wages and real wage income changes, which is going down because of inflation. But you will have the wealth effect among the wealthier households as well once the stock market begins contracting. But it won't be just the stock market that's thrown into chaos. All kind of bond markets are already feeling the crunch here and getting unstable, fragile. Fragile means kind of preliminary to an instability. You know, the municipal bond markets, the high-yield corporate bond markets, the CLO junk loan markets, all those are beginning to show signs of big indigestion. Prices are falling, and you're going to have big withdrawals going on, already beginning in high yield and muni bond markets. So the point is, if the Fed raises interest rates too rapidly, right, or too high, or both, right, it's going to precipitate this financial instability. And it's not going to take very much to do that, in my opinion, because the U.S. economy is so much more fragile now after 2008-9, a very weak recovery after that, and now the COVID impact. There have been fundamental changes in the structure of the U.S. economy, and it's both the real economy and the financial, and it's much more fragile. In other words, prone to instability and contraction. And the Fed won't have to raise rates very much. And I think that number is somewhere around 3.5% in the 10-year bond interest rate for it to precipitate some real financial instability. So I don't believe that the Fed's going to be able to raise rates 5 times here, even if it's only a quarter of 1% that it does so. I think these pundits are... you know, they got their head in the air here and don't understand that the economy has fundamentally changed in the last decade, and especially in the last 2 years. It's much more fragile. And the Fed cannot raise rates that much. Now, historically, that's what the Fed did back in 1980-81. You know, we had inflation, you know, 10% inflation then at 1.14%. What happened? Well, Reagan decided that he was going to take that inflation, which was due to the oil price shock in the Middle East, you know, around Iran and so forth. That's what drove up the prices. Supply side, in other words. And Reagan decided, we're going to shake out this inflation, but we're going to do it at the expense of the average consumer and homeowner and worker. You know, we're going to whack the hell by raising interest rates to 18%. We're going to whack the hell out of the housing construction industry and out of the auto production. And those two industries collapsed quickly. In other words, they almost shut down and laid off millions and millions of workers. And as a result, workers didn't have the income. Didn't have the income. They didn't spend. So consumption, demand declined, and yeah, that eventually brought down prices. In other words, what the government did was make the homeowner, the consumer, the worker pay to shake out the inflation when the inflation was really due to supply side and oil companies. Doesn't that sound familiar? Isn't that kind of where we're at right now? Yeah, it's a repeat. But what's different is that the Fed cannot raise rates to 18%. What's different over 40 years is that the economy is much more fragile and financially fragile than it was 40 years ago. So those rates will not go to 18%. As I said, I don't think they can go much over 3.5%, which is, you know, roughly twice of what it is now. The 10-year rate, I think, is 1.9, somewhere around there. 10-year treasury bond, you know. It can't go over 3.5 without precipitating financial instability and bringing the two important areas of the economy, construction, housing, and autos, to crash as well. Can't do it. So the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. And yet they're calling on the Fed, to shake out inflation when it can't and will give up before it does. But why are they pointing to the Fed and getting the Fed to do that? Because businesses say, we don't want you to cut our taxes, raise our tax cuts, right? We don't want you to do that, right, government? We don't want you to slap price controls on us, right? So let's deflect the whole argument to demand side and then to the Federal Reserve to do something about the demand side. When the whole problem is price gouging, corporate power, right, and the supply side. Yeah. It's a big, big farce. The policy changes they're talking about will not have an effect. Okay. But it will have an effect on slowing the real economy if the Fed raises rates that much. Won't have an effect on inflation, but it will slow the real economy. Or at least that 20% of the real economy that interest rates can affect. We have a kind of a, you know, there's a saying, history first is tragedy, then is farce. What happened in 1980-81 was a tragedy. Reagan made average Americans pay for the inflation caused by the oil companies. That was a tragedy. This time around, it's a farce, right? It's even more absurd, right? Price gouging, supply problems. You're going to take it out on workers' wage incomes? Yes, exactly. That's what the whole thing of the Fed raising interest rates is about. And, you know, you got to consider that, look at it historically, whenever we've had a big run-up of inflation, it's always been followed by a recession. You know, we just talked about 80-81, right? Inflation, recession, 81-82, which is the worst since the Great Depression at the time, right? What about 89-90? Same thing, driven by housing prices mostly, right? And oil prices resulted in the recession of 91-92. We had the dot-com tech boom of the late 90s, 99 and 2000, followed by the recession of 2001. We had the big run-up in housing and oil prices once again in the spring of 2008, followed by financial crisis and recession of 2008-10. Each time you get inflation 10%, right? And the government tries to shake it out, right? And it introduces certain policies, precipitates recessions on purpose, yeah, or can't control a recession that already occurred. You get a recession that follows historically every time. Under neoliberalism, since the 1980s, it's been the same picture. And we are drifting into the same territory once again. We've got significant inflation, supply side, oil driven. Right? We've got, deflect treating the real cause, oil prices and gouging and supply problems. You know, let's not address those. Right? Let's throw it onto the lap of the Fed and make the Fed raise rates with the false argument that's going to do something about inflation. Well, only if it precipitates recession. And once again, we may be moving in that direction. We will see when the Fed actually does start raising rates in March. I think they're going to be very tepid, very careful. And I don't think they're really going to raise rates five times. You know, that's the dummy pundits who are predicting five times rate increases, as if that won't have, you know, an impact on destabilizing the economy, both real and financial. They think we're still living in a pre-COVID, pre-Great Recession world. You know, most of economic theory is based upon that. You know, based upon the fact that the global capitalist economy has become so financialized and so integrated financially and in real terms, you know, supply chains and so forth, you know, that traditional abstract theoretical economic theory and analysis is no longer valid. The economy has fundamentally changed in the 21st century, especially since 2008-09, and now even further because of this latest crisis here in 2020-21, which is still continuing, right? So mainstream economists, you know, got their head up their butts. They don't understand what's going on, in my view, here. They are the victims of their own economic ideology, not economic science. And yet policy is based upon that. Yeah. And you see it no more clear than you see it, well, it's a demand problem. Let's stifle demand to get this inflation under control. But it serves the business interest, you see. It serves the Republican and corporate Democrats and corporations in general interests to deflect the analysis and the explanation of what's going on, why it's going on, because then you come up with policies that take it out on the hides of the average American and household and consumer and worker, rather than taking it out on where it really, really begins and where the real problem is. Okay, that's my take on GDP, which we're going to see weakening here in the first quarter of this year. And probably going weaker. And if the Fed is too aggressive, what we're going to see is precipitating a recession here. And the government is not going to put any more stimulus to offset the weak economic, growing weak economic situation here. Government stimulus is dead. State and local governments are going to continue holding on to their money and not spending it. You're going to have continued supply side problems, export imports. Inventory adjustment here is going to reverse in 2021. And the consumer is getting weaker as you have problems with rising rates and credit. And at the same time, real wages begin to reverse themselves once again. Okay, that's my analysis of GDP numbers and where we're going with them. It's my analysis of the Fed and where we're going with that. And we need to watch that closely and well. Okay. I'm out of here.